On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Hail Caesar! They still cry in the movies, as once they saluted in the heart of ancient Rome and on battlefields from Gaul to Syria. Julius Caesar, general, consul, dictator, is one of the most magnetic and controversial figures in all of history. Few have matched his power, his military and political genius, his glory and his infamy. He raised an empire and destroyed a democratic republic. Many look for lessons in his story today. British historian Adrian Goldsworthy is out with an acclaimed new biography of the man proclaimed a god in the Roman Senate and killed in the Roman Senate. Up next on Point, he came, he saw, he conquered. We're looking again at Julius Caesar. Joining me now from Cardiff, Wales, in the UK is Adrian Goldsworthy. He's a celebrated young historian of ancient Rome and author of The Complete Roman Army, The Fall of Carthage, and In the Name of Rome. His new book, getting rave reviews, is Caesar, Life of a Colossus. Adrian Goldsworthy, thank you so much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. It's very nice to be invited.
There's a lot we want to learn, but give us the basic framework first here. You've got Rome, an empire that stretched, and a republic that stretched centuries. Where does Caesar, Julius Caesar, fall in the arc of Roman history? Give us the broad strokes of the context here.
Caesar's life was almost smack bang in the middle of Rome's greatest period. He's born probably in 100 BC. Rome's still a republic. However, that republic's torn apart by civil war throughout the next few decades. Caesar plays a big role in these. In 49 BC, he crosses the river Rubicon famously and starts a civil war against Pompey and lots of enemies in the Senate, a war that'll spread all the way around the Mediterranean. Caesar ends up the winner. He makes himself dictator, monarch, king in all but name, but he gets murdered. And then it's Caesar's adopted son, Augustus, who becomes the first emperor. So Caesar spans that transition from Rome, a republic where the leaders, at least in theory, are elected, to an effective military dictatorship, which was the empire.
And is it fair, then, to pin the end of the Roman Republic, the end of Roman democracy, such as it was, on Julius Caesar?
It certainly happens, or a large part of it happens in his lifetime, but to blame him for it whilst some people would, I think, is rather unfair. There's a lot of other people out there, all free agents doing their own thing. And the Civil War didn't just happen because of Caesar. The people on the other side were just as willing to put their own selfish interests ahead of the good of the state and tear that republic apart just because they couldn't stand Caesar. So he's there. He's really important. He is one of the key players. You can't ignore somebody like Caesar at any stage in his life. But there's other factors as well. There's other people responsible.
We're going to learn a lot about Julius Caesar in this hour, but it is interesting to me to note you point straight to the passion that Julius Caesar pulls out of historians. We don't think of historians as being breastfeeding, you know, guys and women yelling and getting it so impassioned. But this man, perhaps more than any other in history, really gets the dander, the juices going, the passions up among historians. Why, Adrian Goldsworthy?
It's very hard to say. The thing is, you never meet a scholar who doesn't have a strong opinion about Julius Caesar. They either love him or they loathe him, but they've thought about him, and there's a passion there that, as you say, it simply isn't there for anybody else. I think it's because there's a lack of finality about his character. There's a huge amount to admire in Julius Caesar. Very intelligent, very talented, charismatic, patriotic. He did try and benefit large sections of society in a way that many of the others of the ruling elite did not. But he's also the utterly ruthless individual who is a blatant imperialist. He goes off, he conquers Gaul, raids Britain, Germany. During the course of those campaigns, one source claims maybe 1 million people died and as many more were enslaved. Probably the figure was a bit lower, but it's still, you're talking in hundreds of thousands. So the human cost of Caesar's success, of Caesar's glory, was pretty dreadful for a lot of people, especially non-Romans. And, of course, he is the key figure who sparks the civil war, fights his way to become dictator. So there are lots of bad things. There are lots of morally questionable things about Julius Caesar, but he's certainly not irredeemably bad because he did lots of good things, but he's not perfectly good either, because he did lots of pretty dreadful and unpleasant and very selfish things. So I think it's that mixture. It's very hard to make up your mind, but there's something about the charisma of the man that just comes through even today, and you just can't ignore him.
Mm. Good and bad, indisputably great, whether or not you put a positive cast on that greatness. he straddled a lot. We're going to look at his military record, at his political record, his genius in both of those camps. But introduce Julius Caesar to us first, if you would, Adrian Goldsworthy. And you've put a lot of effort in this wonderful book into this aspect of sort of writing a biography as if it were of a, as much as possible, as if it were of a contemporary figure with the kind of personal element there. Describe Julius Caesar as a human being, a person, a man, if you will, before we go onto the battlefield and onto the Senate floor. He was quite the lover. He was quite taken with the way he looked. Give us his family background, his personality.
Caesar is a man who comes from a very ancient aristocratic family in Rome. So he's born into this small elite, this group of families that dominates the Roman Republic. But it's a family that hasn't done very well for rather a long time. They've been fairly obscure. You know, yes, they claim that they're descended from the goddess Venus and all this sort of thing, but that hasn't helped them to win any elections in recent years. The family's just starting to get going in the generation before him. They're starting to do well again, but Caesar takes it to heights way beyond they could imagine. So he's brought up in a family that tells him he's really special and that he is a descendant of a goddess, and that he has the blood of kings of one of the Italian cities running through his veins. So from the beginning, he's raised to expect to have a prominent, dramatic, glorious career, to be one of the men who shapes the destiny of the Roman Republic. So he's fed these stories right from a very young age, because children of these sort of families, they're educated at home. So you're brought up, you're told all about your family, you're told about Roman history, but it's always the part played by your own ancestors. You know, that's the crucial bit.
And what was his life like before he burst on the great stage of sort of wave-making Roman history, when he's still the younger Caesar?
The younger Caesar has a fairly traumatic time of it. It's one of the things that's easy to forget. We just look at the dates coldly, but when, just a few months after he's born, there's rioting and a massacre in the Forum of Rome that his uncle by marriage, Marius, is heavily involved in. When Caesar's in his early teens, for the first time, a Roman army turns and seizes power by force in the city of Rome, killing anyone who stands in their way. That'll happen two more times during his teenage years. You know, Caesar's growing up, seeing heads nailed to the speaker's platform in the Forum, bodies floating along the River Tiber. It's an extremely disturbed, violent period whilst he's growing up to adulthood. So it's bound to shape his sense of just how precarious life is, particularly for someone like himself who loses family members, who loses relatives when they back the wrong side.
And his personality... I'm sorry, please.
Oh, sorry. When he's only 17, mm-hmm. he's pursued by the followers of the dictator Sulla, who's occupied the place in threat of his life. This is a time when you have the proscriptions, lists of people's names, enemies of the state being posted up in the Forum that removes all legal rights, so anyone can come along and kill them and claim a reward.
And
Caesar's one of these hunted men.
What was it like to be near this man in the fullness of his adulthood? If you were a friend, an enemy, a lover, what was the personality people write of Caesar?
Caesar was very hard to resist. Even people who really disapproved of him politically, when they spent time with him, he was such a charming individual that he won them over. Very witty, very urbane, very bright. He's also someone who's pretty much in love with himself. I mean, he's very careful about his appearance. There's all these stories about him having had all his bodily hair plucked out. He very neat hairstyles, wears distinctive clothing, long sleeves, which wasn't the fashion at all. But Caesar sets the fashion, and the younger generation copy him. To women in particular, he seems to have been almost irresistible. It's quite striking that he slept with the wives of not just his enemies in the Forum, but most of his allies as well. And Caesar's affairs became legendary. There was this, I probably came to the stage where there was the assumption that if any woman spent time in his company, then she was bound to be seduced by him. But one of the most famous is Brutus's mother. Brutus, the man who's eventually going to murder Julius Caesar, his mother, Servilia, was Caesar's long-term lover. But
Everyone who was anyone seems to have been Caesar's lover practically at some
pretty
point.
Pretty much, yes. I mean, he does... as I say, you wonder how much is simply gossip, but there's a lot of truth in the gossip, and he clearly didn't care. Sometimes it's almost as if he's competing with people in the bedroom just as much as he is in the Senate House and the Forum. Mm. You know, he's got to be best.
Was the Roman Republic ripe to fall when Caesar came along, or was it the heat of this man's personality, his drive, that dropped it?
There are big problems that the Romans are facing before Caesar's even born. Roman politics has got increasingly violent. When politicians have their disagreements, their arguments, their disputes over who's going to gain the high office, there's always the risk from then on that it's going to break down into rioting, into assassination, even open warfare. And Rome has changed in the last century before his birth. It's gone from being merely the dominant power in Italy to controller of the entire Mediterranean world. It's expanded very quickly. It's got incredibly rich very quickly through the profits of that expansion and the trade it fostered. So there's a lot more money around. There's a lot more things going on that the old system is struggling to cope. And with a system like the Roman Republic, which is based upon precedent and people following the rules and sort of toeing the line and doing the right thing, there aren't laws to force them to do it. Once they stop behaving that way, then the whole thing begins to come apart at the seams.
We're talking about the life and echoes of ancient Rome's Julius Caesar. Of course, he's been in our ears and before our eyes most recently in the HBO series Rome. Let's listen to a little bit from the trailer right there.
Senators, join with me in building a new Rome. Oppose me, and Rome will not forgive you a second time.
As long as you and I know where we stand.
Where do we stand?
What have they done to you?
Playing at being God?
I'm not playing.
A new era begins for all Rome.
From the HBO series Rome, Richard's calling from Boston. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Well, what do you think?
The question I was going to ask you before you put that segment on is I saw that series, that HBO series on Rome, and it was quite fascinating just from the ethical aspect, just what the ethics of the Romans were at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But two questions for me is, one, Caesar's relationship to Octavian, his nephew, is that realistically depicted in the HBO series? Two, the way Octavian demonstrated both ethics and lack of ethics from a modern point of view today in that HBO series,
great,
the way he was able to kill someone without feeling too much regret.
Without blinking. So the Hollywood depiction, and then the nephew or grandnephew, I think, Octavian. Adrian Goldsworthy, we can't presume that you've watched an HBO series on Rome, so I don't know if you have or not. I've got to ask.
Funnily enough, I have, actually. But
what about the depiction
with
there?
It is, it wasn't bad, but it was obviously aimed as drama, not as history. And we don't know too much about the early years of Octavian when Caesar's still alive. We know a lot more about him after Caesar's dead. So obviously, very high proportion of that was invented because there isn't any information to go on. They probably exaggerated to some extent how close and how important he was to Caesar during Caesar's lifetime. He isn't adopted until Caesar's dead, and it's an adoption through Caesar's will. But I think Caesar must have seen some remarkable talent in the boy in those few years. He was clearly singling him out. He was starting to cultivate him and to think of him as someone who was going to be one of the key players of the next generation. But Octavian is thrust into the limelight more because Caesar gets murdered. Caesar didn't expect to be murdered. He expected to be around for another 10, 20 years. And by that time, Octavian would have been a mature man. His attitude might have been quite different. We don't quite know what Caesar was planning. So in that respect, it took a few liberties with the truth, but it's a drama. You know, you can't expect 100% accuracy.
And then Richard asked, please, about ethics. And I'm curious on that front, because you were saying just before the break that the sort of ethics, even in Roman terms, were breaking down when Caesar came on the scene. What about the ethics of Romans grabbing and wielding power? And what was the fabric that began to come undone on their own terms?
Well, the Romans themselves really explain the fall of the Republic as all to do with a decline in morals. You know, people stopped behaving properly as good aristocratic noble Romans should. Whether they ever really had behaved as well as people thought they did then, harder to say. For Octavian, he clearly is an extremely calculating, ruthless individual. You know, he's the consummate politician. Octavian is the sort of person who is always going to end up winning. And, you know, he's the sort of man who can follow you into revolving doors and come out first. So in a sense, the sort of coldly calculating murder they showed in the series, again, it's all invented. We don't have that sort of information about his early life. But he did get rid of an awful lot of people later on. Octavian didn't pardon his enemies like Caesar. Octavian had them killed.
And down they went. Describe for us, if you would, Roman democracy, the Roman Republic. It was an oligarchy. We look at it as a democracy, but how would it compare with what we think of as a democracy today?
It's nowhere near as democratic on our terms, in that not everybody can vote. You know, you can't vote if you're a woman. You can't vote if you don't own sufficient property. The vote of the wealthier people counts for far more. You can forget about slaves and foreigners and people like that who aren't citizens. They don't even get a look in at all. On the other hand, in a sense, it's more directly democratic because the Romans have their elections every year. So you choose your two consuls, your two senior magistrates, every 12 months. It's not like waiting 4 or 5 years to choose a new prime minister or president. So they have that more direct control. But in the end, nearly all of these people are coming from a small group of families that have got all the money, they've got all the prestige, and they've really got the brand name. Families tend to sort of establish a reputation for being particularly good soldiers or good administrators or just capable. Mm-hmm. And they keep on telling you what all their ancestors have done under the assumption that the next generation is going to be just as good. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to compete against that if you don't have a reputation, if your family is obscure.
We're going to march through the history of Julius Caesar, but take us to the end in a way before we start so we can listen to this with the kind of modern echoes in mind. In its heyday, the British Empire, Toynbee and all the rest, thought a lot about the Romans. Americans thinking about Romans now, about the health of democracy, about empire, this word very much in American ears these days. What do you think of parallels that get drawn between the time of Julius Caesar and this time, let's say? How valuable is this history for contemporary, let's say, Americans to think about their own history, their own circumstances, or not?
Well, sometimes it's fashionable, particularly in critics of American policy, to sort of say America's the new Rome. It doesn't really work as soon as you look closely. Usually the people saying it don't know much about ancient Rome and probably don't know much about modern America either. But there are some parallels and there are maybe some warnings. One thing that is significant is that the Roman word imperium, where we get our empire from, that means power. Doesn't have anything to do with physically occupying territories, provinces. They did do that. But in the end, they talk about expanding their power. So in that sense, America, as the only superpower in the world at the moment, is in, to some extent, a similar situation to Republican Rome that was the overwhelmingly dominant power in the known world. There are particular lessons, you know, the way the Roman political system broke down maybe gives us a warning of just how fragile democracy can be, even limited democracy like they had in Rome. And how as soon as people stop playing by the rules, abandon the conventions, and also get caught up in their own individual political disputes, rivalries between individuals in their case, perhaps parties today, and forget about the real issues, so ignore things that are going on. People in Rome were quite content to let, if they're in the Senate, let a problem that everybody admitted was a big problem, like what to do with the poor citizens in Rome. They'd let that problem keep going rather than let somebody else they didn't like get the credit for solving it. Better to leave the problem lie.
Hundreds of years of Roman democracy gone in a couple of generations, and Julius Caesar right in the middle of that. Begin to take us into some key points in this life that really did straddle the world as it was known then. Around 59 BC, he's in the middle of this first triumvirate that gets formed, really begins to step up into power. Describe what happened there for us.
Well, Caesar has struggled to make himself famous. He's now 40. He's able to stand for election to the consulship, the highest office. He's put himself hugely into debt to get there. When he's had any government post, he's pumped his own money into making sure it's done even better than anybody else can do it. He's put on these incredibly lavish gladiatorial disgraces. So Caesar is virtually bankrupt. He's relying on his creditors to gamble on the fact that he's still going to be successful. And Caesar then does the really unexpected. A lot of his rivals are expecting him to crash and burn at this point, get to the point where simply no one's going to trust him anymore. But Caesar goes to the two most powerful men in Rome, Crassus, the great financier, the man mm-hmm. who was probably the wealthiest man in the world, and Pompey, the great general, neither of whom are particularly popular with the rest of the Senate because they are so powerful. And Caesar does a deal with them secretly. If you ally with me and support me, help me to get elected, then I'll make sure that all the things you want doing, all the laws you want bringing in, I'll do it personally. And a lot of people, a lot of Romans, dated the end of the Republic to that secret decision when the three most powerful men decided almost to carve up the state between themselves.
Was this new? You describe lots of money as changing hands in Rome's Republic toward the end, in any case.
There's huge amounts of money. It's one of those problems. It's like being elected today. If you're mounting an election campaign, you spend so much money on advertising that you've got to try and spend more than your opponent or spend it more wisely than your opponent. And then the next year, the new candidates, or the next time round, they're going to have to spend even more. So things keep spiraling out of control. And there are lots of other people like Caesar who are gambling on the fact that they will be successful. They're borrowing money, hoping they'll win the office, they'll be able to pay it back. And if they don't, they're desperate. So you have a system where the amount of money being spent sometimes blatantly to bribe the voters is getting greater and greater all the time.
Was there any secret that he was arm in arm with the richest man in the world, Crassus?
It took several months for people to realize. They were a bit suspicious at first. There'd been some connection between the two before, but not that much. The thing that really surprised people was when they realized that Pompey, the other most powerful man, who absolutely loathed Crassus personally, they couldn't stand each other, was willing to join the other two. And it's probably only Caesar who could have brought these two men who hated each other together and made them understand, look, this is our best chance. If we want to get what we want, we've got to work together.
A political genius who always moved and willing to break the rules to do it. Also a tremendous military genius. And in ancient Rome, these two often went hand in hand. Take us to 52 BC, if you'd be good enough, in the Battle of Alesia. Here we are in Gaul with Caesar showing military genius of a really kind of just astounding height even today.
It is quite staggering when you look at it that Caesar has been in Gaul for 6 years. He's conquered it up to the Atlantic coast, up to the English Channel with Britain, up to the Rhine in the east. He's just carved out this great new province for the Roman Republic, making himself massively wealthy in the process by plundering the place, selling people off as slaves. He's also, however, realized all along that it's fine being a general, it's fine winning all the battles, and he's very, very good at that. There are few commanders as gifted as Caesar in all of history. But it's not enough just to win the battle. You've got to win the peace afterwards. So Caesar's also a consummate diplomat. He convinces enough of the Gaulish tribes that it's in their interest to ally with Caesar, to ally with Rome, to stay loyal to him, because the alternative is that he'll turn up with the legions and devastate them. But also he gives them enough incentives. He gives them enough perks, enough advantages. But the problem is in 52 BC is that whole system breaks down. And even most of his friends turn against him. They finally realize that Caesar's been here for 6 years. He isn't going to go away. The Romans have conquered us. Individual chieftains have done well from Caesar. He's made them kings of their tribes, but now they want more, and they can't see a way of getting it without him. So virtually the entire population of Gaul rebels against him. And the campaign is a very tough, very brutal one that goes badly for the Romans. And Caesar, however, gets beaten at a place called Gergovia, is retreating from that. Everything looks really black. He wins a relatively minor skirmish when the Gauls try and chase him, and immediately turns on them and goes straight for the jugular. Chases them down, hunts the Gallic leader Vercingetorix, pens him up in a hilltop town, surrounds him with a wall of fortifications. And when all the other Gallic tribes raise a huge army, many times bigger than Caesar's legions, to come and relieve that siege, Caesar builds another line of fortifications facing outwards. So he's trapped sandwiched in the middle.
Wow.
And, you know, anyone in Rome looking at hearing about this must have thought, well, this is it for Caesar. He's bound to die here. The army's bound to be slaughtered. It's all going to end in defeat. But Caesar doesn't. He wins. He pulls a victory right out of at the last minute. And no one can quite understand how, but he manages to outthink his opponents, get his men to endure just a little bit further, to fight that little bit harder, and destroys the Gallic army, destroys the rebellion. He then goes back to the patient diplomacy and puts together a province that'll work, where people again agree that, well, it's better to be Caesar's friend than his enemy.
A military genius, a political genius who always took the initiative in war, in politics, rumored to know the name Of every soldier that served under him, I don't know if that's true, but that was a lot of soldiers. Let me get a call from Des Moines, Iowa. Darren, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. The point that I wanted to bring up as pertains to Caesar's relevance to our own times is that in my, albeit limited, reading, it seems to me that the ascension of Caesar marks the beginning of the end for Rome, really, as a civilization, because at that point, when it becomes an empire is always the beginning of the end, it seems, for civilizations up to that point. Prior to that point, the republic, where the society protected the individual, from that point, it seems to me that the in the imperial stage, the value of the individual is what he can do to support the state. And I find that possibly a little troubling as I view our current times. I'll take your response off the air. Thank you very much.
Darren, thanks very much. The beginning of the end in Julius Caesar, Adrian Goldsworthy?
Depends a little bit how you judge civilization. On a sort of basic level, Rome's a lot wealthier after Julius Caesar. And if you look in terms of culture, well, Caesar's age, it's the age of Cicero, Caesar himself, who was a great writer, is a great flourishing of Latin literature, of poetry, of rhetoric. That continues under Augustus, and really for another century or so. So Rome is prosperous, Rome is more peaceful. To some extent, it depends who you are. If you were doing well out of the Republic, if you were one of the wealthy, if you were one of the Senate, then you lose a lot of power, a lot of influence when the empire comes along. If you were an ordinary citizen, then it's a little more, it's a little less clear. You know, the emperors do try and rule for, at least the best ones, for the greater good. They do try and deal with some of the social economic problems, not just the small interests of the upper class. If you lived in the provinces of the Roman Empire, then the empire, at least at first, was a very good thing. You've got a situation where, under the Republic, senators go out to govern provinces and try and make as much money as they can by squeezing the provincials. When they go home, they'll only get put on trial by other senators who want to be able to do the same thing themselves, so aren't going to condemn them. Under the empire, the emperor doesn't want a rebellion, so he stops that.
Of course, drama loves Caesar. Here's a scene from the 1953 MGM movie Julius Caesar, starring Louis Calhern as Julius Caesar and Marlon Brando as Mark Anthony. He won his third Oscar nomination here. Caesar's talking about the kind of men he'd like to have around him.
Antonius, let me have men about me that are fat, sleek-headed men, and such as sleeper knights. Yond Cassius has a lean and hungry look. He thinks too much. Such men are dangerous.
Dan's calling from Davenport, Iowa. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I thought, I find your program interesting, but I think that the author quickly dismissed the idea that Caesar's lessons of conquest of power and conquest of territory is sort of inapplicable to our current situation. And I think if you only look at America as a political empire, I can see that it's weak. But in many ways, the closest parallels to Caesar aren't political, but economic. Our corporate chieftains are operating on a logic very close to the kind of power maximization that Caesar was exercising.
So you see, Caesar is not in Washington, but in corporate boardrooms today, but they have many fiefdoms, not really a single empire, do they?
In my judgment, we are headed towards a monopoly capitalism on a global scale, and whether it is Bill Gates or Warren Buffett or the head of ExxonMobil, it really doesn't matter. The logic is one of global conquest and of the elimination of not political rivals so much as economic rivals, and the kind of conquering of the political institutions of our world using just brutal economic power.
Brute economic power. Dan, let us pick it up. Adrian Goldsworthy, what about it? It's just impossible for people to take their eyes away from this empire parallel. Dan points to the concentration of power by whatever means and says, yes, we can learn here.
Perhaps that's true. I mean, there are similarities, certainly. There are aspects and there's elements of detail where, yeah, maybe similar things are going on. You don't really have the equivalent of that sort of economic power in Rome, or at least if it was there, we can't see it very well. You know, we know about Crassus and people like that who had all this money and who mm-hmm. used it to buy political power, but we don't know much about how business functioned in the Roman world. And they didn't really have the concept of corporate business law and that sort of thing that we have. It's hard to say because it's always easier for a historian like myself to go and look at something 2,000 years ago rather than tell you perceptively about what's going on today. Mm-hmm. It's a lot easier when the past has happened and is nailed down.
But what do you see about about action-reaction here, concentration of power? I mean, did Julius Caesar take that concentration to an unsustainable point? Was there a loss of ethics in the action of concentrating it that made it untenable in ethical human terms?
In a sense, Caesar was merely the most successful of a lot of politicians who were thinking exactly the same way. Mm-hmm. And at least when he had power, he used it rather better. The traditional elite of the Senate has become more and more focused upon its own personal power. So in that sense, you could see it as competition between rival corporations or the financial powers behind them. In terms of what they want is a state that is purely run for their benefit. And anything else that happens, yes, that's for the general good, is fine as long as it's in their interest as well. Caesar is a little bit better than that. Mm. The senatorial elite, the traditional aristocracy, has got incredibly selfish by this period. Mm. And that's one of the reasons why men like Caesar become the only alternative for the rest of the population. You know, when the voters get sick and tired of voting for a consul who's only out for his own interests, mm-hmm. then the charismatic leader like Caesar, in some ways you could perhaps argue that if you want to see the world being increasingly controlled by corporate interests, that it's almost an invitation to someone like Caesar to appear to oppose that, but then to take power into his own hands. But I think we're quite a long way away from that as yet, anyway.
You write that you see him truly as a patriot, but of course he also became a rebel and dictator. Take us to that moment, the famous crossing of the Rubicon, January 49 BC. Paint the picture, and then the offense to the Republic that Caesar committed with that wade in the water, and what followed?
Well, Caesar has just spent the last decade in Gaul. He's been sent there by the vote of the Roman people. It's all been legally done. He's been given the right to command. He's been given the legions. And he's gone off and he's made use of those powers in an extremely ambitious, robust and ruthless way. But the state's rewarded him. There have been public thanksgivings voted time and again to honour his achievements. Everyone back in Rome has been openly praising him. But a significant group within the Senate have hated him all the way through and are simply suspicious and are waiting for an opportunity. The problem with the Romans is that when someone's actually in office, there's no mechanism for removing them from office. There's no impeachment system. Mm. You have to wait until they're a private citizen again, then you can put them on trial, then you can destroy them politically. Mm-hmm. Caesar knows that's what his enemies want to do to him when he comes back. And by the end of his command in Gaul, he's left with a choice, because as soon as Pompey, his old friend and his son-in-law, changes sides and joins Caesar's enemies, he knows that they have the military capacity to fight him. So if he comes home and lays down his command, then he's probably going to be forced out of politics into exile. Mm-hmm. The alternative is to fight a civil war. Now, the steppe is marked by just a little stream called the Rubicon, which marks the formal boundary of his province, where he legally can control troops, lead his army, and Italy, where he can't, where all his powers lapse. And Caesar crosses that in January 49, having decided that he's been backed into a corner. The alternative is political extinction. Mm. And he's willing to plunge the Roman state into civil war to protect his own reputation. The only thing you can say to mitigate that is that his enemies are willing to plunge the Roman state into civil war simply to destroy Caesar's reputation and status. So it's very selfish all round.
When he took the title of dictator, did he see that as the end of the Republic, or did he describe it as a state of emergency to save the Republic?
As far as he's concerned, the Republic is, as in Latin, it literally means the state, the public thing. It doesn't mean a particular institution. And Caesar is full of trying to rule for the good of all, trying to improve things for Romans of all classes, also trying to improve things for many of the people in the provinces. Some of them he'll give Roman citizenship to, others he'll try and improve their status, protect them from corrupt governors. So Caesar is trying to rule well, he's trying to rule for the good of Rome, but it's very difficult to know just what he wants in the long term. But the last 4 years of his...
Please.
Sorry. The last 4 years of his life are spent almost constantly fighting wars, mm-hmm. fighting campaigns. He doesn't have a lot of time sitting in Rome to plan things.
But when we read Cicero, and we quote him here, describing Caesar as destroying the Roman constitution, does that mean to Cicero what it appears to mean to our ears?
Not quite. I mean, Cicero has complained about lots of other people destroying the Roman constitution over the last few decades. Mm. You know, almost any action he finds repellent. So, for instance, a law that was going to redistribute some land that was owned by the state, give it to poor citizens, set them up as farmers so that you could then tax them and they'd then be contributing members of society. Cicero saw that as the end of the Republic, the end of the constitution. You know, the rhetoric of Roman politics tends towards extremes, and yet they bounce back, and a few months later he's telling you how wonderful Caesar is. So it's one of those things where there were things people didn't like, but for the aristocracy, as far as they were concerned, the central point of the Republic, of the constitution, was to prevent any one individual from getting supreme power. And Caesar achieved supreme power, so that was the problem.
We've got a lot of listeners with questions. Kathleen's calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Kathleen, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I think this is great. I'm just fascinated by Caesar. And it's very popular, it seems, to credit him or blame him for the fall of the Republic. And I wonder if that's just because he's famous. I mean, I'm thinking about, I may not be pronouncing their names correctly, Gaius Marius and Lucius Cornelius Sulla and their civil war in the decade or so before, you know, a couple decades before Caesar, when he was a young child, and how Sulla, you know, marched his own soldiers across the Rubicon and into Rome. And it was, you know, once somebody's already done it, it's easier for you to do it, and how the army was, under Marius, was transformed from a gentleman army to a paid army where the soldiers were loyal to their general, you know, dependent upon them to get compensation and land after they were done serving.
So lots of hands in the pot here.
Yeah, and it just seems like, you know, most people have never heard of those two individuals. And it seems like, you know, the Republic, the way it had existed for, you know, hundreds of years, really changed significantly under their leadership of Rome. And it seems more like that Caesar was, you know, if it wasn't Caesar, somebody else would have come in and ended it.
Kathleen, let us turn there. Adrian Goldsworthy, the sort of view that this was in train. Or did it take Julius Caesar, in your view, to push it the final distance into what Rome became?
I think the state was already pretty rotten by the time Caesar was growing up and moving onto the public stage. And, you know, yes, Marius and Sulla had fought the first civil war, they'd marched on Rome, they'd seized power by force, they'd changed the nature of the Roman army. It was going to be very, very difficult to go back from that position. And Caesar, of course, is the nephew of Marius, so he's associated with that from the beginning. And it's difficult to see that anyone really had any clear ideas of how to solve all the problems the state was facing. Lots of people just didn't want anybody else to do it, didn't want anyone else to have power. Mm. Probably somebody else would. Cicero argued that had Pompey won the civil war instead of Caesar, that you would have ended up with a different dictator, but you still would have had a dictator. And it's very hard to see how that could have been avoided once you end up with someone with so much power. So, in a sense, yes, you're right. It's Caesar's the famous name. Caesar, because he wins, because he's successful, becomes the name that will then be taken by all the rest of the Roman emperors. It becomes the name that will be taken by the Kaiser and the Tsar, you know, in more recent history. Caesar as a name is associated with power in a way that just gives the name a resonance that these other Romans, famous though they were and great men though they were, simply don't have anymore.
But clearly he was not just another man in line, as you describe him. From New York, Gray's calling. Hi, Gray, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, everybody. I just had a question. I read a while back that when Vercingetorix was actually captured by Julius Caesar, that he posed a question that, you know, why do you take all our simple things, essentially in different words is what he was saying, to Julius or to the Romans, and I was wondering if he ever got answered.
Adrian Goldsworthy, can you flesh that out for us?
Right. It's actually a little bit later. It's a British chieftain, a fellow called Caratacus, from the area of Wales where I'm talking today, who was captured by the Emperor Claudius, and he's taken back to Rome in triumph, walks around the city of Rome, seeing all these massive buildings, and looks at the Romans and says, well, hang on a minute, if you've got all this, why do you want our mud huts? No, he doesn't get an answer. But the striking thing is that the Roman historian Tacitus is the one who tells us this story. So the Romans themselves were always a little bit unsure about aspects of their empire and some of its more negative aspects. Tacitus, in another speech he puts into the mouth of a Scottish chieftain, uses the words, the Romans, you know, talk about their empire, but they just create a desolation and they call it peace. Mm. So the Romans were quite critical. You have the sort of debate that you have in modern countries about, should we be conquering an empire? Should we be the aggressors? You know, it's not quite as clear-cut. The Romans weren't all convinced all of the time that their empire was a good thing.
Caesar, of course, Julius Caesar, famously off to Egypt, and Cleopatra off to Syria and that realm where he came and saw and conquered. And then come the Ides of March, our time grows short. But describe the end to us. And what was this backlash? Was it just the backlash of other powerful men? Was it the backlash of principled men? Take us to the Ides of March and the famous murder.
The conspirators who killed Julius Caesar are quite a mixed bunch. You've got Brutus and Cassius as the famous leaders, but there were lots of other men, and quite a few of them were Caesar's former lieutenants, men who'd done very, very well indeed through Caesar's victory, but had obviously decided at this point that they could do even better if Caesar was off the scene. And Brutus and Cassius, on the other hand, had both fought against Julius Caesar in the Civil War. They'd fought and they'd lost, but they'd been pardoned by him. And they hadn't just been pardoned, Caesar had actually promoted them. So you've got this odd mixture of people who really owe Caesar a lot, but who've decided that Caesar the individual, and in particular Caesar the dictator, isn't compatible with the Republic. There's lots of motives going on. I mean, there may be a lot of very personal reasons as well. Caesar's been having a long-term affair with Brutus's mother. There are rumours that Brutus is really his illegitimate son. Rumours aren't true, but they still keep on getting repeated. He's also probably had an affair with Brutus's sister, a woman called Tertia, who's married to Cassius. So you wonder how much. I mean, everyone tends to stress the politics, but there's a soap opera element about those last few months where you start to wonder just how many conflicting emotions are coming in for them to do this and finally to pounce on Caesar and stab him to death in such a brutal way.
And the lines, as we know them from Shakespeare and legend now, is that how it actually happened? You too, Brutus?
Not quite, unfortunately. There's one source that claims that he may have said, "You too, my son," when he saw Brutus stabbing him, playing on that, not just the rumours about his paternity, but also the fact that Caesar had treated him so well. Mm-hmm. The other one is that he just turned around angrily and said, "Bloody Casca, what do you think you're playing at?" and stabbed one of them with his pen. I must confess that one in many ways sounds more likely. Caesar was trying to fight his way out at the very end. He'd never got used to the idea of losing. There was always a way out. There always should have been. There always had been up till then.
He was quite a writer himself, as you put it. Our time is so short, but in Caesar's own writing, was there ever any indication of doubt, any self-doubt, any question of whether he had gone too far in the pursuit of his own power, glory?
No, not at all. I mean, he doesn't even mention crossing the Rubicon, the start of the Civil War. But one of his officers who was with him in the carriage later wrote a history, which fragments preserved or traditions preserved, where he is supposed to have got out of the carriage, stared at the river and agonized for ages, wondering about whether or not he should take this step. But then, of course, he actually does take the step. There's very little trace. We tend to see the formal, official Caesar. There's a lot about the inner workings of the man we just don't understand because it's not the evidence.
Well, you've certainly brought me closer than I've ever been. It's a wonderful biography. We're grateful to you for your time today and for your work in this history. Adrian Goldsworthy, author of Caesar, Life of a Colossus, with us today from Cardiff in Wales. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.